The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Within hours of bombs exploding in Belgium, grainy, closed-circuit images surfaced of the three suspects pushing luggage carts in the airport. Anti-terrorism and security officials across the globe are hoping to prevent similar attacks using a technology that could recognize and flag a suspected terrorist before they reach a crowded airport or subway station. Facial recognition technology is already being used by some law enforcement on social media platforms and in consumer gadgets like digital cameras. Increasingly, facial recognition and other biometrics are also being considered to replace passwords for identification. But there is a disconcerting flaw in this increasingly ubiquitous software. Not everybody's face is recognized equally. Rose Eveleth is host of the podcast Flash Forward and a contributor to Vice, where she wrote about the inherent bias of facial recognition software. She's joining us now on Skype. And Rose, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So you talk about some very clear cases where facial recognition has failed pretty spectacularly. Can you share some of those cases with us?
Yeah, so there are a couple that have come up recently. Google's image tagging algorithm actually labeled a pair of friends who are African-American as gorillas. Flickr's system actually made the same mistake and tagged a black man with the tag animal and ape. Nikon's cameras, and this is a little bit older example, but Nikon's cameras were designed for a while to detect when someone blinked, and they often told Asian people that they were blinking, even when they were not. And sort of the classic first example that I think a lot of people maybe saw a couple of years ago was HP had some webcams, and they were supposed to track a face, and when a white person moved in front of the camera, it immediately picked up the face and tracked them, and when a black face moved in front of the camera, it didn't see it at all. Mm. So there's a lot of examples of this. It sort of seems like there's all kinds of ways that this comes up over and over, but those are some of the probably the most famous ones.
So what does that reveal to us about how the technology is created and who it's designed to serve?
So algorithms, you know, people think like, oh, algorithms are just computers and they can't have bias because they're computers. And in some ways that is true because it is a computer and it does not yet think on its own. However, it is designed by people. And we know very well that people have a lot of inherent biases that they aren't aware of and some of them that they are aware of. And so very rarely is it the case that some engineer, you know, is sitting at Google and saying like, aha, I'm going to make this algorithm, you know, be racist. But what they do is they train these algorithms on sets of images and sets of faces and sets of things that they're going to show them to say, hey, when you see this, this is what you're looking for. This is what an eye looks like. This is what a nose looks like. This is what you're looking for when you see an eye is open. And often those sets of data that they're training the algorithm on are made up of faces that look very similar. So mostly European, mostly white people. And so when the computer sees a face that looks different, that is not a white face, it doesn't really know what to do because it hasn't seen enough of them to know how to respond. So it makes these mistakes. Now, in some cases with like Google and Flickr, when we talked about the people being labeled as gorillas or animals, that's an even more complicated problem because they're trying to solve something that's more complex than facial recognition. They're trying to teach their computer to recognize any object. So they want to know this is an apple and this is an orange and this is a tree and this is a person. And that's even harder. And that means that they're showing it fewer of the same kind of thing, so fewer people, which means that it sort of amplifies this question of the computer not really knowing what it's looking at.
But still, the idea that a white face is a normal face, I guess, is what we're coming away with. Have you spoken to anybody in the technology business who designs this to see how they responded to questions about bias?
Yeah, so I've talked to a couple of people who work on facial recognition, and all of them say the same thing. They say, you know, we're not going in trying to make a bias system. But what I think a lot of them don't quite realize is that many people who go into technology aren't trained in sort of what bias looks like and how to detect it and how to sort of make sure that it doesn't get coded into their system. And it can seem like a system is really, really accurate. Like it can, you know, work 97% of the time, and that might seem really great. if the 3% of people that it's failing on are all Asian or all African-American, that's a problem. And it might not be detected by them because they don't necessarily see it. So one of the people I spoke with said, I don't think it's a problem because those are minor issues. You know, when I asked about, you know, does your system, some of them try to detect gender, and I asked about trans people and they sort of say, oh, that's a little issue. There's so few of them, it doesn't matter, because they're really looking at a percent accuracy and not necessarily at sort of the human cost maybe that some of this might entail.
So do you think that's a legitimate argument? You know, it's never going to be 100% accurate. So if a few slip through the system, it's okay.
I don't think so. I think in general, technology companies need to be aware of the real world impacts of some of this. And particularly when you're talking about groups that are more vulnerable, that are sort of already facing a lot of discrimination, there are little things that add up to just a reminder constantly that, you know, we don't think about you when we design. And also, you know, as you mentioned, facial recognition software is going to be used more and more, maybe as a password, maybe as a way to get in and out of a building. And if the system doesn't recognize you because it's not trained to, that starts to become more and more problematic in your actual life. And there are clear examples of biometrics sort of failing people in pretty catastrophic ways, you know, when trans people travel through an airport. So I think that engineers need to really be aware of the fact that, yes, you're designing a system, and yes, accuracy is important, but it's not just about a percentage. It's also about the people that are impacted by your system.
Well, what can be done to combat this?
So there are some things that are really simple. You know, hire a more diverse team that maybe would see this before it goes out. But also, you know, if you're feeding your system data, make sure that that data is diverse. And that's not necessarily a trivial thing to do. It can be difficult to find big sets of face data. And, you know, some places will trawl Facebook and some places will look for public images. But just making sure that you're aware of the data that you're feeding your algorithm, because it really can only learn from something that you teach it. You know, it's like a kid. If you never teach it something, it doesn't know that thing, and you can't really be mad at it for not knowing because you never taught it. And so if you're only teaching it on white faces, then, you know, that's on you to sort of find other sets of data to show your algorithm. And I think also there are a couple of people who work on algorithmic fairness and are trying to kind of see what they can do to, you know, detect and prevent bias in some of these algorithms. And so companies could work with them as well to help sort of try to nip some of this in the bud before it gets blown out and gets shipped out and into a product.
Rose, we're talking largely about non-white populations not being recognized or being left out because of this technology. But is there a flip side? I mean, if facial recognition software is being used by law enforcement or airport security struggles with non-white faces, couldn't that also lead to some very specific gaps in security, you know, almost like reverse racial profiling?
It's possible. I mean, I think that there's an interesting flip there that you mentioned, which is that, you know, we know that racial profiling is not technically allowed, but it's definitely something that people think about when they design these things. And so I think it's also, you know, it could be a problem. If you are only training your security database using black and brown faces, that's also a problem, because then you're saying, oh, we've decided that we think a terrorist looks like this and not like that. And that's a whole other sort of flipped problem, which is like what you said. And so I think in general that, you know, if you're making a decision and saying that a person that does X looks like Y, that's a bias. That's a thing that you've decided. And I think it's worth stepping back on companies, whether you're making a security application or whether you're making a consumer application, to say, okay, I'm making a lot of assumptions about what the person that I am looking at is going to look like. And maybe I need to back up a little bit and see why I'm deciding that and what that means and whether that's accurate and whether that's fair.
Rose Evela, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Rose Evela, she's a contributor to Vice, where she wrote about bias and facial recognition software. She's also host of a podcast, Flash Forward. There's more on both at wordofmouthradio.org. Facial recognition and other forms of biometrics are now being touted as critical tools for personal security and for public safety. But no form of personal protection, whether it's a padlock or a password, is 100% secure, at least not anymore. This story comes to us from Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible.
A man walks down a dark alley. He's dressed all in black. He approaches a door, drops to one knee, and produces from his pocket a small metal tool. He inserts the tool into the keyhole, He deftly slides the tool around inside the keyhole until he's in. Security has been breached.
The pursuit of lockpicking is as old as the lock, which is itself as old as civilization.
Producer Sam Greenspan.
But in the entire history of the world, there was only one brief moment, about 70 years, where you could put something under lock and key, a chest, a safe, your home, and have complete, unwavering certainty that no intruder could get to it.
A feeling that security experts call perfect security.
And since we lost perfect security in the 1850s, it has remained elusive. Despite tremendous leaps forward in security technology, we have never been able to get perfect security back.
Locks go back at least as far as ancient Egypt.
But in March, I'm dropping a big paper theorizing that the Mesopotamians were actually the creators of the original lock and that the Egyptians then learned it from them.
This is Skylar Town.
And I am a security anthropologist.
From the Middle Ages on, for hundreds of years, locks were not very good.
There was no perfect security. There was no lock that could keep everyone out.
And then in the 1770s, an English guy named Joseph Bramah entered the locksmithing scene. He made something called, aptly, the Bramah safety lock.
Bramah disconnected the key from the bolt.
Take my word for it, explaining how this thing works does not make for compelling radio. But the main thing about this lock is that it added levels of complexity in between the key and the bolt. It's like a whole Rube Goldberg scenario plays out inside the lock. The key touches one thing, which moves another thing and triggers this other thing. And he also had another idea that would revolutionize locksmithing.
He also contributes the idea of turning this whole thing into a contest.
Showmanship.
So as soon as he has a padlock version of this lock that he is very confident in, he puts it in the window of his store in Piccadilly.
And he paints on it a message, a challenge.
And it remained in that window for 70-plus years, challenging all comers, and everybody failed to open it.
Bramah's new unbeatable lock and the hoopla surrounding it caught the attention of the British Crown. And they wanted to up the game. They wanted a lock that wouldn't just be unbreakable, but would also alert the owner if someone tried to get into it.
The government sponsored a contest with £100 as reward.
The best one at the time was Jeremiah Chubb's detector lock. And the way that this worked is that when you lifted one of the tumblers up too high, it would actually trip a latching mechanism.
And when that happened, the lock would completely freeze up.
And going forward, the names Bramah and Chubb are basically interchangeable for perfect security.
But only until the Great Lock Controversy of 1851.
In 1851, an American named A.C. Hobbs traveled to London for the Great Exhibition.
Back in the States, Hobbs had made a name for himself as a sort of white hat security consultant. He'd go visit banks and say, "Hey, if I can break the lock on your safe, you want to buy one of mine?" Hobbs was a natural. And naturally, on day one of the exhibition, he successfully picked the Chubb detector lock in front of a crowd.
He actually opened the lock pretty quickly.
But the Chubb detector lock was really just a warm-up. The main event was the Bramah safety lock. A.C. Hobbs threw down the gauntlet.
So a trial is conducted against the Bramah lock. They give him 30 days to conduct himself against it. He winds up working on this thing for about 52 hours over the course of 14 days and finally gets it open.
The Bramah lock had been opened.
When Hobbs opened that lock, I swear to you, the world changed.
Overnight, the feeling of perfect security had evaporated, and we have never gotten it back.
And that story was produced by Roman Mars and Sam Greenspan of 99% Invisible. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Got milk? How about filtered, high-protein, low-sugar, lactose-free milk? With soda sales sliding downward, beverage colossus Coca-Cola is betting that designer milk could become a billion-dollar brand. Bloomberg News reporter Shruti Singh and Jennifer Kaplan looked into Coke's new venture. And Shruti joins us now with more. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
This is a new area of business for Coke, which has a venturing and emerging brands group. So they've already done Zico coconut water, you know, Honest Tea, fused juice drink. So what are they banking on for milk?
Well, Coca-Cola is looking at milk as a potentially next billion-dollar brand for them. They see some things that are going on in the food space that may lend themselves to some success in milk. A couple of things that are going on in food is that consumers are trying to find more natural foods, clean labels, higher protein. And so this is something that's very attractive to a consumer foods company.
So they have partnered with a dairy cooperative and come up with Fairlife is what they're calling it. Their CEO, Steve Jones, he has some background already with Coke. What's the relationship there?
So Steve Jones previously was the president of Coca-Cola's Minute Maid juice company. And he also served as the chief marketing officer at one point for all of Coca-Cola. Then he sort of went into semi-retirement, and then he connected with the co-founders of a milk cooperative called Select Milk Producers. Select Milk Producers and Coca-Cola found each other, and 2 years later they created this joint venture called Fairlife, which has now produced this high-protein, low-sugar, lactose-free milk that's also called Fairlife.
How much is this selling for?
It's selling for about $4 for a 52-ounce bottle, and that's about double what the conventional stuff sells for.
How about organic milk, which fetches a higher price?
It's going to be the Fairlife brand still. It's still more than organic.
So a few other players in this space, Dean Foods, what are they and what do they bring to the table?
So Dean Foods is the largest dairy processor in the U.S., and in 2015, just a couple of months after the launch of the Fairlife milk, Dean Foods launched its national Dairy Pure milk brand. And previously, Dean used to have a lot of different regional milk brands because Dean bought a variety of different brands throughout the years. And now what they've done is under Dairy Pure, they're co-branding with their regional milks because they want to also tell consumers that we are producing this milk locally, we care about your regional brand, but here's this Dairy Pure brand that's going to promise you things like no artificial growth hormone, testing for antibiotics, things like that.
We're still talking about just milk here, right? I mean, why Coke is banking on a product that seems a little outdated? I mean, supermarket shelves, they're already being squeezed with organic milk, with non-dairy, soy milk, almond milk, rice milk. Are people still drinking traditional milk?
So sales of traditional milk or per capita consumption of what you would call traditional milk, sort of the big gallon jug that we're used to, per capita consumption has actually been declining in the U.S. for decades. I think what's happening right now in the milk industry and why Fairlife has entered the market, why Dean Foods is starting to put out different types of milk as well, is that the milk industry is looking at what consumers are looking for. Are they looking for high protein? Are they looking for more calcium? Are they looking for no antibiotics? They're trying to create these products that are hitting specific consumer needs.
How about flavors?
Yeah, so Dean Foods actually has created a variety of different flavors. They introduced this brand called Trumu in 2011, and they have put out seasonal flavors like orange cream for Halloween. Cookies and cream is coming up for the summer. Obviously got your regular chocolate, but then they also have chocolate marshmallows. So they're experimenting with a variety of different flavors that goes beyond the basics of what we've known flavored milk to be.
Or health food, for that matter.
So they're trying to pitch this to moms as something that's healthier than, say, the conventional chocolate milk because Trumu doesn't have any high fructose corn syrup.
So it seems like they're up against a lot. So is Coca-Cola banking on its significant marketing and distribution muscle to kind of change the game? Or are they counting on changing the product to fit what consumers are looking for now?
I think that's why this joint venture came about, because Select Milk Producers had this product, which was the brainchild of a veterinarian turned farmer named Mike McCluskey. He came out with this filtration system that allows the company to create a milk that's high protein, low sugar, lactose free, because he's able to separate out the different parts of milk to create a milk that's going to meet different consumer needs. So he had that product. What he lacked with this particular product was the marketing, distribution, and other expertise that Coke had. And so that's why this partnership came about in one sense.
So more processing will mean more money. Will people pay, Shruti, for designer milk?
Well, in the first year on the shelves, Fairlife has actually been able to reach more than $90 million in sales. And so that's going, you know, towards a little ways towards that billion-dollar brand that Coke is trying to make.
Shruti, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Shruti Singh, she covers food and agriculture for Bloomberg News. She and Jennifer Kaplan, who covers consumer companies, including Coca-Cola, together wrote, Coke thinks designer milk could be a billion-dollar brand. We've got a link to read the article for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org.
My milkshake brings all the boys to the yard, and they're like, it's better than yours. Damn right, it's better than yours. I could teach you, but I have to charge. My milkshake brings...
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Sleepy time tea. It's like a package of goodness in the cupboard. A bear in a nightshirt and a cap dozing off by the fire. That soothing smell, that innocuous herbal taste. Some 1.6 billion cups of sleepy time were sold last year, making it by far the best-selling tea for celestial seasonings. With its mystical name and vaguely flower child aesthetic, you might not guess that the company, Celestial Seasonings, was founded in the 1970s by devotees of a quasi-religious cult that was, in terms of the day, pretty far out. Its teachings were thought to be dictated by aliens to a human, and many early followers were prominent eugenicists plotting to rid our nation of inferior races. Megan Giller is a freelance writer, and she looked into the twisted history of sleepy time for Van Winkle's. Megan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So Mo Siegel and John Hay figure prominently into this. Two founders, how did they get into the tea business?
Yeah, so they were both living in Colorado in the late 60s, early 70s, and they were very much involved in that kind of alternative culture there. And they started hiking up into the mountains and they thought, well, wouldn't it be neat to make tea out of the herbs that we're finding up there? And so they went up in the Rocky Mountains and they gathered a whole bunch of herbs and started offering them as different, I guess, blends. The first one was actually called Mo's 36 Herb Tea because it had 36 different herbs in it.
And this was the first time herbal tea was really packaged to the masses in the United States, correct?
That's right. They kind of invented that category. It had never really, there was no such thing as herbal tea.
They were also avid followers of the Urantia book. Am I saying that right?
I think so. I'm pretty sure that's how you say it. I haven't heard it out loud that much myself.
U-R-A-N-T-I-A. This is a huge tome, thousands of pages long. Tell us a little bit about its origins.
Yeah, so it was thought to be, it's considered a direct voice book, which means that it was told to a person by, in this case, celestial beings or aliens. And supposedly it was translated this way by this man named William Sadler, who supposedly listened to the words coming through his brother-in-law's kind of in a trance. He was telling him all of these words. And eventually the brother-in-law wrote down this huge tome. And so this is said to be directly from, you know, these aliens translated to into a language that humans could understand.
And when was that?
That was in the early 1900s, probably around 1910 to 1920 something.
So despite its paranormal origins, there are many characters that are recognizable in Judeo-Christian religions. You know, we have Satan, we have Adam and Eve, we have Jesus. But what are some of its, let's say, unorthodox teachings?
Yeah, well, so for example, you mentioned Jesus and Adam and Eve. And so while those do figure into the book, one of the things they say is that there's actually many different Adams and Eves and on many different planets. And there are many sons of God like Jesus on many different planets, too. And so Adam and Eve are brought to each planet. They are aliens themselves, and they're brought to each planet to kind of, in the words of the Urantia book, upstep the native race, basically. And so through kind of mating with the higher beings on that planet, they will create a more perfect race. And so I guess on Earth, this didn't exactly happen. And so Adam and Eve kind of have to figure out, and humans have to figure out what to do in that case.
Okay, there's so many things here. I know. It sounds pretty New Age, pretty 1970s. So is it fair to call it a cult?
I think that it has some elements of a cult. And I talked to several experts about this, too, about whether it's fair to call it a cult. And obviously, the Urantia book would say that the people who follow it would say that it's not. But I think that it has some of those elements for sure, yes.
Well, I'd never heard of it. Was it influential at its time?
So there are very few followers of this book, but it was influential, and it was especially influential in Celestial Seasonings and the way the company is run. So Mo Siegel and John Hay, who are the two founders, were profoundly influenced by the Urantia book, and they actually ran their company for a long time based on the ideas in the Urantia book and the ideals in there, and kind of use that philosophy to guide their business sense and business decisions.
We're talking about Celestial Seasonings, that vaguely hippie-esque company that makes Sleepy Time and other herbal teas. Well, the company was founded in the 1970s by a couple of flower children who were indeed celestially inspired. They were devotees of the Urantia book, which claimed to have paranormal origins. But I want to pick up on what you said about Adam and Eve upstepping the natives. This is pretty problematic, but it is very much in the early 20th century when eugenics was really catching on in the U.S. So what are some of the teachings about race in particular in the Urantia book?
Yeah, so basically that this, all of these kind of native races exist right now and need to be eliminated in order for illness and disease to be eliminated from the world. And so to do that, you know, the sterilization, no intermarriage between races. There's a lot of talk about which race is most superior to the other. It gets into some nitty gritty stuff. And then also the teachings of the man who's thought to be kind of behind the Urantia book also point towards that very strong eugenics viewpoint. In the article, I actually quoted Hitler, which sounds a lot like some of the things that that the Urantia book says. And I'm trying to find that exactly. Let's see. Mm-hmm. So in the Urantia book, it says biological renovation of the racial stocks, the selective elimination of inferior human strains will tend to eradicate many mortal inequalities. And then Hitler in Mein Kampf says, the demand that defective people be prevented from propagating equally defective offspring represents the most human act of mankind.
So you're talking about the beginning of the century and then, of course, picking this up in the 70s with Mo Siegel and John Hay, who are still, by the way, both alive. Are they both still followers?
Well, actually, I don't know about John Hay, but Mo Siegel is on the board of directors of the Urantia Book Foundation, and he hosts study groups at his house once a week.
So he had grand designs for Celestial Seasonings as a brand. He wanted it to be as big as Coca-Cola. Where is it today?
Celestial Seasonings is huge. It's really the market leader in terms of herbal tea. And I mean, I'm sure everyone actually probably has some Celestial Seasonings tea in their pantry. And like you mentioned, Sleepy Time Tea has become a huge market leader as well.
Well, is Mo still involved with Celestial Seasonings?
No, as far as I know, he is not involved. The company was sold in the 90s, and so he retired. He's definitely around, though. And John Hay is also involved in a lot of big companies that you would know just offhand.
Well, your article for Van Winkle's drew some fire, it looks like, from an active and offended group of followers from the appearance of it, of the Urantia book. They say it has nothing to do with the Seventh-day Adventists, which you mentioned in the article, and that the eugenicists mentioned were kicked out of the movement. So what's your answer to those critics?
So the Seventh-day Adventists, it is related in the sense that the man who was thought to be behind the Urantia book, William Sadler, was originally a Seventh-day Adventist, and he left that movement. So it starts with the Seventh-day Adventists, but then branches off to its own thing. And as far as them being kicked out, I have not heard anything about that. And in fact, if you read the 20 most asked questions on the Urantia Book Fellowship website written by Mo Siegel, I have a direct quote here, and it says, illness and disease result from evil and cause suffering. Unfortunately, several factors hinder progress toward the development of a disease-free world. At the present time, mankind loses about as much progress as it makes by ignoring eugenics. So they specifically cite eugenics on their site as related to the Urantia book. So I'm surprised to hear that they say all the eugenicists have been kicked out.
Well, I will let you talk to them, Troy. Megan Giller, thank you for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Megan Giller wrote the article Cults, Conspiracies, and the Twisted History of Sleepy Time Tea for Van Winkle's. She's a freelance journalist and also runs the Chocolate Noise website. You'll find a link to more at wordofmouthradio.org. To be clear, one source that Megan spoke to for her story said that the Urantia book does not represent a destructive cult, but some of its self-proclaimed prophets, lead groups, that can be seen as destructive cults. Indeed, there are much darker examples throughout history where cults have proven to be malevolent and lethal. In 1978, the California Congressman Leo Ryan was murdered on a fact-finding mission to Guyana, where cult leader Jim Jones had set up the settlement that came to be known as Jonestown, and where more than 900 of his followers would eventually be ordered to drink deadly poison. In this episode of StoryCorps, Leo Ryan's daughter Erin remembers her father.
My dad had a fair amount of self-confidence and bravado, and when he was trying to investigate prison conditions, he spent a week in Folsom Prison, which at the time was California's maximum security prison, and he spent it on death row. He originally had wanted to go into the prison undercover. Thankfully, the prison officials wouldn't allow him to do that. And on the cell block, they used to play chess. One person on the block would have the chessboard, and they would call out moves to each other. And this was a chessboard that they had made out of toothpaste and toilet paper with a cardboard board. And when he left, they presented the chess set to him. It was one of the most moving experiences of his life. And it became his prized possession. The night before he went on the trip to Jonestown, he had had dinner at my apartment. I was going to college at Georgetown University, trying to teach myself how to cook. And it was just a chance to hang out with my dad. Dad had done a lot of adventurous things in his life, and everything had always turned out well. So we didn't talk a lot about the trip. You know, I think looking back, if I'd known more, I might have been more concerned. I heard the news around 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening, and there was a flash news report on the television that said that a congressman has been shot and possibly killed. Pretty much that was it. It was gut-wrenching to not know what was happening. I mean, I can still feel it to this day when I think about it. It was brutal. And we struggled then for a very long time. You know, my message to the families of the victims of this tragedy, Congressman Giffords and those who were killed, I mean, for me, it's been 32 years, and it can still bring me to tears. But you can't make that a defining moment of your life. I've always said to myself that I was lucky that he was my dad, and I was lucky to have had him for the years that I had him. And that's what you have to hold on to.
And that was Erin Ryan speaking about her father, Congressman Leo Ryan, for StoryCorps. There's more word of mouth coming your way after a short break. Don't go away. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you remember the 1960s, you weren't really there. Well, that quote has been attributed to about a dozen icons of the anti-establishment. For them and countless others, LSD was the psychedelic ticket to tune in to the deeper meaning of life and drop out of societal constraints and aspirations and mind-deadening jobs. Now, taking tiny doses of LSD, or microdosing, is being touted as a way to drop in to workaday life. Publications from the Huffington Post to Forbes report that microdosing is a hot new business trend and Silicon Valley job enhancer. The journalist and author Baynard Woods was intrigued by the idea of acid improving job performance, so he decided to try it and wrote about the experience for Vox. A note here that we are talking about the use of a drug that, while becoming popular in many circles, is still illegal. Baynard Woods, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So microdosing is not about getting high. What is it then supposed to do?
So it's supposed to enhance your performance. your creativity, your focus, and function more like Albert Hoffman, who discovered LSD, had said one time that if it hadn't been scheduled so strictly that it would be used more like Ritalin as a focus kind of drug.
Yeah, it does sound like some of the prescription brain boosters that we hear, you know, helping you focus, helping you tune in. How is it then different?
One of the main differences, and I had also have taken Adderall and Ritalin before, and so one of the things that I found very much different than that it was more task-driven in a way. So the energy wasn't satisfied just by screaming at someone on Facebook or, you know, scrubbing the floor or something like that. It wasn't just a compulsion to work. But if I was doing the task that I was doing, I found myself sometimes maybe more deeply engaged in that task than I would have otherwise.
Well, LSD, it was famously the substance of serious research at Harvard under Timothy Leary in the 60s, now again being studied at Harvard, Johns Hopkins, along with psilocybin, MDMA for treating a host of things, PTSD, addiction, even some mental illnesses. So has there been any study into microdosing acid?
There hasn't. And being here in Baltimore, the Johns Hopkins studies are right up the road. And so I know and interviewed all of the people that are involved, or many of the people involved in running those studies. And it's actually from an entirely different tradition of psychedelic therapy. Microdosing builds on the idea of psycholytic therapy, which was the idea of taking a small dose of acid and then doing something like Freudian psychoanalysis to achieve better insight into yourself. Whereas what they're doing at Hopkins is the head researcher there, Bill Richards, just came out with a book called Sacred Knowledge. And it is about giving very large doses that essentially, he argues, bring you to the state of unitative consciousness, of feeling one with the universe, and then helping you reintegrate that into your life through therapy, both before and after. So it's a very different thing. And there are currently no double-blind or any kind of rigorous academic studies being done with microdosing, partly because the idea is going out, you know, they can do the Hopkins studies in a very safe lab environment, but if the idea is to go about your ordinary business, it's harder to do that.
Well, you did your own sort of researching, a party of one. First, there are some very specific processes for microdosing. Can you run us through that a little bit? What did you do?
Sure. And so the research that is going on primarily comes from James Fadiman, who's a psychologist in California. And he started collecting accounts from people. So he did come up with a protocol that suggests that every 4 days that you would take a microdose, which would be about a 20th of the average sort of recreational dose that people would take, you know, on blotter paper or whatever of acid. And so it would be a very, very much smaller amount of that. You would take it early in the morning because it does last about 12 hours. And I did feel, you know, that it probably would have been difficult to sleep after that. So I took it in the morning, and I was wildly unscientific. I mean, just to be clear, I got the drug from an illegal source, had no way other than most illegal drug users through most of history than to trust my dealer to know what was actually there. And I people often will mix it in distilled water. I didn't do that. I just snipped off a little teeny corner, put it on my tongue in the morning, and waited to see what would happen, and tried to forget as much as possible that I had taken it. All of these things make it a extremely unscientific, but a phenomenological type of study.
Hmm. Well, you are a writer, you know, you're often working alone in your office. I think at this time you were working on a book proposal. What did you notice? What was it like?
So yeah, I was working on a book proposal, and which sort of in itself was taking a bunch of material I had already reported on, people who believe in the ancient Greek gods, and then trying to arrange it in a way that would make sense. And so it was sort of like one of those playing with blocks sort of things. And I felt that there was an almost, I mean, this is starting to get into the trippy kind of language that is sort of trying, but almost like more 3D sort of experience of thinking about the way chunks of prose or ideas would sort of fit together into a larger structural whole. And I would find that 2-3 hours would pass and I would have been so deeply engaged in the work that I wouldn't have been aware of that passing of time. And then the most striking thing I found was that it really broke. Being a reporter, like most reporters, I'm addicted to Twitter and knowing what's happening at every minute. And it really broke that cycle to where I could use that if I needed to, but I didn't feel the compulsion to get online. I didn't feel the compulsion to get up in the morning and check Facebook and Twitter and Instagram or whatever for an hour or two before I started functioning.
So, as currently advertised, this idea of being a job enhancer, making you more aware, more present, more functional. But we've all heard the stories of the bad trip. You know, the person who just got too high, went too deep, or became delusional or triggered something in the brain that was just too frightening to contemplate. Did you experience anything like that?
I didn't in that way. I did have some negative effects. The worst thing was actually from mixing alcohol with it. I had a meeting at a bar and we ended up drinking and it sort of went longer than one would expect. After that, I felt there were about 3 days that I couldn't sleep well and felt like I had these sort of night terrors of falling into a hole almost. And so I would caution that you have to have a certain level of psychological robustness to even want to try this. And one thing they're very cautious about is you shouldn't do it if you're on antidepressants, because much of the antidepressant serotonin came from LSD research. And so they work in similar ways. And so they don't know how those would interact. And also, you know, my job at that time was I wasn't working in an office other than my own office. I mean, if you had a job like on the sitcom The Office, absolutely don't do this. It's only going to make your life much more miserable than it already is, would be my guess.
We're going to hear right now from a couple of people who did not hear that advice not to do it at work. This is from the podcast Reply All. Fia Benin and PJ Vogt, who are both producers of the podcast, both secretly tried microdosing in the workplace and recorded what happened next. And as you're going to hear, one of them had a very different experience than the other.
How come you feel sad?
It's hard for me to sort out. I feel like doing it on the weekend with you felt fine and fun and good. And bringing it into the workplace felt like, I think it felt like bad to feel like I was like trying to hide something from everybody around me.
Yeah.
Like that's the difference between Monday when we were just like having a nice day together and like I told my community and everybody was like checking on me and being supportive. And instead this was like trying to have like a little secret inside myself.
Yeah. In retrospect, this seems obvious, but if you're going to take a drug because of the promise that it'll connect you to everybody and everything, you probably shouldn't build a wall of secrecy right through the middle of your experiment.
PJ Vogt speaking with Fia Benin, who have very, very different experiences microdosing. The secretive nature comes up for them because they were in an office space. But how about for you, Baynard? Would you do it again?
Yeah, I think I would. I found that it was intriguing and interesting, and I wish there were studies. I think that it's something we should have. There could be really great promise in using something like this. But I also am a little bit suspicious. One of the reasons I wanted to try it is I'm a little bit suspicious of this idea of become a better worker for the capitalist workforce or whatever, and turning this thing that was seen as really revolutionary into another way to make you, you know, in 60s parlance, more productive for the man. I'm suspicious of that. And so I was glad I was at least doing my own work. And I don't know that I would want to take a drug to be better for someone else's work.
Baynard Woods, thank you for speaking with us and sharing that experience.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Baynard Woods, he's a journalist and author, and he wrote for Vox about microdosing on LSD, which apparently is a big trend in Silicon Valley and other places to make people more productive. There's a link to read his full article at wordofmouthradio.org.
What you're listening to are musicians performing psychedelic music under the influence of a mind-altering chemical called LSD.
And that's all that we have time for today. Always happy to have you along. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also find stories and conversations going on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio, and on Twitter, at Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow, too, with more Word of Mouth here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.